Much better. Possessed by a sudden and nearly irresistible impulse to pull her clothes again, he reached instead for the cloth to wipe away the remaining soap. Thank you, sister. Brother Dentos was a good man, she said. I'm sorry. He was the son of a whore who grew up in a place where everyone hated him. For him, there was no other role in this world than to fight and die in service to the Order. But you're right. He was a good man, and he deserved a longer life and a better death. Why did you come here, Valin? Her voice was soft, the anger gone now, her tone merely sorrowful. You detest this war, I can see it. Your skills, like mine, were not meant for this. We are supposed to serve a faith that defends against greed and cruelty. What are we defending here? What did the king promise or threaten to force you to this? The impulse to lie, to continue to wallow in secrets as he had for years, was only the faintest whisper now, a nagging sense of stepping too far on an uncharted path, easily overridden by the need to tell her. If he couldn't hold her, at least he could find some comfort in confidence. He discovered my father has become a denier. The Ascendant sect, I believe. Whatever that is. We leave our ties of blood behind when we give ourselves in service to the faith.
Do we? Did you?
Your compassion was born somewhere, sister. In those streets you came from? Amongst those beggared people you try so hard to save? Do we ever really leave anything behind? She closed her eyes, face downcast, unspeaking. I'm sorry, he said. Your past is your own. I don't mean to... My mother was a thief, she said, eyes open now, meeting his gaze, a harsh, unfamiliar accent coloring her tone. Finest dipper the quarter ever saw. Hands like lightning, could have a ring off a merchant's finger quicker than a snake takes a rat. Never knew my father. She said he was a soldier, lost to the wars. But I knew she done some whoring before she learned the trade. She taught me, you see. Said I had the hands for it. She looked down at her hands, the deft, slender fingers clenching. I was a darling little thief, she said, and a thief never needs to be a whore. Turns out I wasn't quite the thief she thought I was. Fat old rich man with a fat old wife managed to corner me when I lifted her brooch, was beating on me with his walking stick when my mum knifed him. No one hits my sherry, she said. She could have run, but she stayed. She crossed her arms, hugging herself. She stayed for me. She was still stabbing away when the guard came. They hanged her the next day. I was 11 years old. After the hanging, I sat down and waited to die. Couldn't steal any more, you see. Just couldn't. And it was all I knew how to do. No mum, no trade. I was done. Next morning, a pretty lady in a grey robe asked if I needed help. He couldn't recall standing or pulling her close, but found her head was on his chest, breath catching as she fought down tears. I'm sorry, sister. She breathed deeply, her sobs fading, lifting her face, a small wry smile on her lips, whispering, I am not your sister, before she pressed them against his. You taste, Sharon's tongue played over his chest, of sand and sweat. She wrinkled her nose. And you smell of smoke. I'm sorry. She giggled a little, raising herself to kiss his cheek before pressing her nakedness against him, her head resting on his chest. I'm not complaining. His hands played over the slim smoothness of her shoulders, drawing a sigh of pleasure. I had heard that one had to be experienced at this to find it truly enjoyable, he said. I heard that true devotion to the faith would blind me to the lure of such pleasures. She kissed him again, longer this time, tongue probing his lips. It appears you can't believe all you hear. They had lain together for hours, making love with urgent, whispered intimacy. Scratch posted outside the door to discourage visitors. The wonderful, electrifying feel of her against him, the caress of her breath on his neck as he moved in her was overpowering, amazing. Despite the grief and the guilt, and knowledge of what waited beyond this room, for now he was, perhaps for the first time he could remember, truly happy. The dim light of dawn was filtering through the shutters on the window, and he could see her face clearly, her smile of serene bliss as she drew back. "I love you," he told her, fingers tracing through her hair. "I always have." She nuzzled against him, her hand playing over the hard muscle of his chest and belly. "Really? After all these years apart? I don't think love like that can ever really fade." He clasped her hand, fingers entwining. "The black hold. Were you... did they hurt you?" "Only if terror is a kind of torture. I was only there for one night, but the things I heard..." She gave a small shudder, and he pressed a kiss to her forehead. "I'm sorry. I had to know. Your words must have carried great weight to have worried the king and Aspect Tendris so. This war is more than just a mistake, Raylan. It sullies our souls. It is against the faith in every way. I had to speak out. No one else would, not even Aspect Alera, though I begged her to. I started standing up in market squares and shouting it out to anyone who would listen. To my surprise, some did, especially in the poorer quarters. My words were written down, reproduced with that new ink and block device the Third Order uses. Pamphlets were being passed around in growing numbers, saying things like, "End the war and save the faith." "Has a ring to it." "Thank you. It took 2 weeks for them to come for me. Brother Iltis sent his men storming into the Order House with a king's warrant for my arrest. Brother Iltis is not the kindest of men, as you noticed, and took great delight in explaining to me in detail what was in store in the Blackhold. I lay awake all that night, listening to the screams. When the cell door opened, I nearly fainted with fear, but it was Princess Lerna, with fresh clothes and a king's order for my release into her custody." "Lerna? What stratagem lay behind this, I wonder? Then I am in her debt. And I. Such a kindly and courageous soul is rare. She made sure I had everything I needed, a fine room of my own, books and parchment. We spent many hours talking in her secret garden. You know, I think she's a little lonely. When I left on receiving your summons, she even cried. She said to give you her warmest regards, by the way." "Kind of her." He was keen to change the subject. "What did he offer you, Janus? I know he must have tried to ensnare you in some kind of bargain." "Actually, I only met him once. The guard captain, Smolin, took me to his room. Rumors were flying around the city and the palace that he's not a well man these days. And I could see it clear as day in the grayness of his skin, the way his flesh hung on his bones. Probably the onset of age, coupled with some wasting illness. I offered to examine him, but he said he had physicians aplenty. After that, he stared at me for a moment or two, and asked me just one question. When I gave him an answer, he laughed and told the captain to take me back to Princess Lerna's quarters. It was a sad laugh, full of regret." "What did he ask you?" She shifted, rising to her knees, the sheets falling away to reveal her slender form. Her eyes glittered, and he realized she was crying. "He asked if I loved you. I said I did. And I do." Her hands caressed his face with trembling fingers. "I do. I should have gone away with you when you asked, all those years ago. The morning he awoke after the agony of her cure, after the Aspect massacre, after she had saved his life, I thought it was a dream. Then it was one we shared." Her hands stopped in mid-caress, her tone suddenly hesitant. "One we could still share. There is no longer a place for me in the realm, and there is a whole world I've yet to see. We could see it together. Perhaps find a place where there are no kings, no wars, no people killing each other over faith and gods and money." He pulled her close, enfolding her in his arms, rejoicing in the warmth of her, inhaling the smell of her hair. "There is something I have to do here, something that has to happen." He felt her stiffen. "If you mean to win this war, you must know that it is a fool's hope. The Empire stretches for thousands of miles, from desert to frozen mountains, with more people than there are stars in the sky. Fight off one army and the Emperor is sure to send another, and another after that. No, not the war. A task given to me by my aspect. And I can't run from it, though I want to. When it's done, our dreams will be our own. She pressed closer, her lips touching his ear, whispering, You promise? I promise. He meant it, with all his soul, and couldn't understand why it felt like a lie. The moment was broken by a loud growl from the hallway. General Norrin, voice unnerved in the face of the angry slave hound, called to him through the door. Sharon put her hands to her lips to suppress a laugh and shrank into the covers as Velin reached for his trews.
What is it? He demanded, pulling the door open. There's an Alperin at the gates demanding you come and fight him, my lord.
General's eyes slid from Velin's face to snatch a glance at the room beyond, before fixing on the still growling Scratch. Captain Antesh offered to feather him, but Brother Canis thought you might want him alive.
What does he look like, this Alperin?
Big fellow, graying hair. Dressed like one of those horsemen we fought at the beach. Seems in a bad way. Having a hard time staying in the saddle. Too long in the desert, I think.
How many with him?
None, my lord. He's all alone, if you can believe such a thing.
Tell Brother Frentis to muster the scout troop and inform Brother Canis I'll be there directly.
My lord. He closed the door and began to dress. Are you going to fight him? Sharon asked, emerging from the covers.
You know I'm not.
He pulled his shirt on and leaned over to kiss her. I need you to do something for me. Captain Nelisan Nestor Heverin sat slumped in his saddle, a desolate fatigue marring his unshaven face. However, as the gate swung open and he caught sight of Velin, his evident exhaustion was replaced by grim satisfaction.
Found the courage to face me, Northman, he called as Velin approached. I had no choice. My men were starting to lose all respect for me.
He looked beyond the captain to the empty desert.
Where's your army?
Fools led by a coward, Heverin spat. No stomach for what needed to be done here.
God's curse, Everin, desert-born scum.
The Emperor will take his head. He fixed Velin with a stare of pure, unbridled hatred. But I'll have yours first, hope-killer. Velin inclined his head.
As you wish. Care to dismount, or do you want it said you had an unfair advantage?
I need no advantage. Heverin slid from his saddle with difficulty, desert sand shifting from his clothes, his horse giving a snort of relief. Velin surmised he had been in the saddle for days, and noted how his legs sagged for a moment before he straightened.
Here.
Velin unslung the canteen on his shoulder, removing the cap and taking a drink. Quench your thirst, lest people say I had the advantage. He replaced the cap and tossed the canteen to Heverin.
I need nothing from you, Heverin said,
but Velin saw how his hand shook as it held the canteen.
Then stay here and rot, he replied, turning to go. Wait!
Heverin uncapped the canteen and drank, gulping down the water until it was empty, then tossing it aside.
No more talk, hope killer.
He drew his saber, planting his feet in a fighting stance, flicking a sudden rush of sweat from his brow.
I'm sorry, Captain, Velin told him. Sorry for the hope, sorry we came here, sorry I can't give you the death you hunger for. I said no more talk!
Heverin took a step forward, saber drawing back for a thrust, then stopped, blinking in confusion, eyes suddenly unfocused. Two parts valerian, one part crown root, and a pinch of chamomile to mask the taste. Velin held up the canteen cap he had switched for the one containing Sharon's sleeping draught.
Sorry. You?
Heverin stumbled forward a few steps before collapsing.
No,
he grunted, desperately trying to heave himself upright.
No.
He thrashed for a while longer, then lay still. Velin called to the Nilselin soldiers manning the gate.
Find him somewhere comfortable but secure, and make sure you take all his weapons.
Frentis arrived with the scout troop, reining in beneath the arch of the gatehouse.
Couldn't it be much of a fight? he observed as the Nilsalians carried off Heverin's unconscious form.
"I've taken enough from him," Velin replied. "His army's nowhere in sight. Circle out to the west. See if you can pick up their trail."
"You think they're making for Untesh?"
"Either there or back to Marbellus. Stay out for one day only, and take no chances. If you're spotted, ride back to the city."
Frentis nodded and spurred his horse forward, the scout troop following close behind. Velin watched them ride towards the west, and tried to ignore the faint trill of unease from the Bloodsong. Night came with no sign of Frentis. He waited atop the gatehouse, gazing out at the desert, marveling again at the clearness of the sky here, the vast array of stars shimmering above the night-black sands.
"You worry about him?" Sharon appeared at his side, her fingers briefly touching the back of his hand before she folded her arms beneath her robe.
"He's my brother," he replied.
"The captain still sleeps?"
"Like a child.
He's as well as a man could be after days in the desert with little water.
Don't get too close to him when he wakes. He'll be angry.
He hates you very much."
Her voice was heavy with regret.
"They all do, these people, despite what you did for them.
I killed the heir to their empire, and brought a foreign army to their city. For all I know, the Red Hand too.
Let them have their hate. I earned it."
She moved closer, casting a wary glance at the guard nearby, who seemed more preoccupied with the grit under his fingernails. "The mason heals well, but his sleep is troubled. His burns still cause him pain. I dull it as best I can, but he still rants in his dreams, speaking languages I've never heard for the most part, but some in our tongue." Her gaze was intent, questing.
"Some of the things he says..."
He raised an eyebrow.
"What does he say?"
"He talks of a song, of singers, of a living wolf fashioned from stone, of a vile and deadly woman, and he talks of you, Velin. Maybe it's just nonsense, delusions, and dreams born of drugs and pain, but they scare me, and you know I'm not easily scared."
He put his arm around her shoulders and pulled her close, ignoring her glance of alarm at the guard.
"What does it matter now?" he asked.
"Your position, your role here.
Let them mutiny. Depose me if they like."
He had raised his voice so the guard could hear, although the man was now intensely interested in looking anywhere but at him. If he was any judge of soldierly gossip, it would be all over the barracks by morning. He found he couldn't care a jot.
"Stop it."
She shrugged free of him, flustered but also suppressing a laugh. The guard cleared his throat, and Velin turned to find him pointing out at the desert.
"Troop returning, my lord."
The gate swung open to allow the scout troop to enter at a weary trot. Velin instantly alarmed that Frentis was not among them.
"The Alperin host was less than 10 miles from Untesh when we found it, my lord," explained Sergeant Halkin, Frentis's second in command.
"Brother Frentis elected to ride ahead and warn Prince Malsius of the danger. He ordered us to return here and bring word to you."
Velin briefly clasped Sharon's hand and strode off towards the stables, calling over his shoulder, "Fetch Brother Barkus and Brother Canis." Chapter 10.
"Well, that's that," Barkus said.
"Clever," Canis murmured. "We didn't give this Alperin enough credit, it seems."
A thick column of smoke rose from the city of Untesh to stain the morning sky. Hundreds of corpses littered the ground before the walls, where scaling ladders reached up to the battlements like stacked kindling. Through the smoke, Velin could see a standard snapping in the breeze, crossed sabers of black on a red background, the same standard he had seen at the oasis. The Alperin battle lord had eschewed siege for an all-out assault, accepting dreadful losses to reclaim the city for the Emperor.
Untesh had fallen. Prince Malsius and Frentis were dead or captured.
"I am a murderer."
"We should keep this from the men," Canis said. "The effect on morale..."
"No,"
Velin said.
"We tell them the truth. They know I won't lie to them. Trust is more important than fear."
"You could have made it out," Barkus suggested, although his tone lacked conviction.
"Got to a ship, maybe."
Velin closed his eyes,
trying to calm his thoughts, attempting to cast the blood song forth, as he had when he lost Dentos in the sandstorm. The note was even, unwavering, and found no answer.
"He's not there," he whispered, hope surging in his breast.
He had entertained a half-mad notion of waiting until darkness, then finding a way over the walls to search for Frontis amidst the aftermath of the battle, although he was fully aware the most likely outcome would be a swift death. But if he's not here, then where? He wouldn't have deserted the prince.
"Outriders," Kena said, pointing to the plain before the city, where a body of horsemen were raising a thick cloud of dust as they galloped towards their position.
"Can't be more than a dozen." Barkas unhitched his axe from his saddle and unfastened the leather cover on the blades.
"A little recompense for the prince and our brother."
"Leave it." Velen pulled on Spitz's reins, turning him away from the city.
"Let's go."
Another month passed as they waited for the storm. He trained the men hard, drilling them until they sagged with exhaustion, ensuring each man knew his place on the walls and was fit and skillful enough to at least survive the first assault when it came. He sensed their fear and growing resentment, but had no answer to it but more training and sterner discipline. To his surprise, their mingled fear and respect held true, and there were no desertions, even after Barkas returned from a reconnaissance to Marbellus, with news it too had fallen.
"Place is near a ruin," the big brother related, swinging down from his horse. "Walls breached in 6 places. Half the houses wrecked by fire. I lost count of the Alperians camped outside."
"Prisoners?" Velen asked. His brother's usually cheerful visage was entirely grim.
"There were spikes on the walls, lots of spikes, each one topped with a head. If they spared anyone, I didn't see him.
The Battle Lord, Aloysius, Master Solis.
What fools we were to let the old bastard send us here," Barkas was saying.
"Get some rest, brother," Velen told him. At night, Sharon would come to him, and they would make love, finding blessed relief in intimacy, lying coiled together in the dark afterwards. Sometimes she would cry small, jerking sobs she tried to hide.
"Don't," he would whisper. "All be over soon." After a while, her sobs would subside, and she would cling to him, lips covering his face with a desperate urgency. She, like every other soul in the city, knew what was coming. The Alperians would break over the walls like a wave, and he and every other realm subject in arms would die here.
"We can go," she said one night, imploring. "There are still ships in the harbor. We can just sail away."
His hand traced over her smooth brow, the fine curve of her cheek, and the elegant line of her chin. It was wonderful to touch her face, to feel her shiver at his touch, before a warm flush crept over her skin.
"Remember my promise, my love," he said, thumbing a tear from her eye.
He was touring the walls the next morning, when Canis came with word of realm vessels approaching the harbor.
"How many?"
"Near 40. His brother appeared unsurprised by the turn of events. The idea that the king would leave them to wither unsupported seemed not to have occurred to him at all.
"We're to be reinforced."
"There has been talk," Canis said, as they waited on the quayside watching the first ship steer its way past the mole and into the harbor. His tone was uncomfortable but determined.
"About Sister Sharon."
Velen shrugged.
"Well, there might.
We've hardly been discreet." He glanced at Canis, regretting his levity in the face of his brother's discomfort.
"I love her, brother."
Canis avoided his gaze, his tone heavy. "According to the tenets of the faith, you aren't my brother now."
"Excellent. Feel free to depose me. I'll happily hand this city over to you.
Your position as Lord Marshal of the regiment and commander of this garrison was given you by the king, not the order. I have no power to depose you. All I can do is report your transgression to the aspect for judgment."
"If I live to be judged."
Canis gestured at the approaching ship. "We're being reinforced. The king has not failed us. I think we'll all live a while yet." In the distance, Velen could see the rest of the fleet bobbing sluggishly on the swell.
Why do they linger out there? He wondered, a realization dawning as the ship drew nearer, and he saw how high it sat in the water. This vessel carried no reinforcements. Sailors threw ropes to soldiers on the quay as the ship tied up to the dock. A gangplank quickly heaved over the railing. He had expected some senior Realm Guard marshal to descend, and was surprised by the appearance of a figure clad in the expensive garb of realm nobility, making an uncertain passage from ship to shore. It took a moment before Valin pulled the man's name from his memory. Keldon Altelnar, one-time Minister of Royal Works. The man following Altelnar was more to Valin's expectation. Tall and simply dressed, in a robe of blue and white, with a neatly trimmed beard and mahogany dark skin.
Lord Valin!
Altelnar bowed as Valin came forward to greet them.
My lord?
May I present Lord Merilyn Nestor Velsus, Grand Prosecutor of the Alperian Empire, currently acting as ambassador to the court of King Janus. Valin gave the tall man a bow.
Prosecutor, eh? A poor translation,
Merilyn Nestor Velsus replied in near-perfect realm tongue, his tone cool and his eyes tracking over Valin with predatory scrutiny. More accurately, I am the instrument of the Emperor's justice. Valin wasn't sure why he started laughing, but it took a long time to subside. Eventually he sobered and turned to Altelnar.
I take it you have a royal order for me?
These orders are clear to you, my lord. Altelnar was nervous, a faint sheen of sweat on his upper lip, his hands clasped tightly together on the table before him. But his clear satisfaction at being involved in a moment of such importance appeared to override any trepidation he might have harbored about delivering these orders to such a famously dangerous man.
Valin nodded. Quite clear.
They were in the council's room at the Merchants Guild, the tall Alperian Grand Prosecutor the only other occupant. The lack of witnesses had peeved Altelnar, making him inquire as to the whereabouts of a scribe to record the proceedings. Valin hadn't bothered to answer.
I have the king's word in writing.
Altelnar produced a leather satchel and extracted a sheaf of papers bearing the king's seal.
If you would care to...
Valin shook his head.
I hear the king is unwell. Did he give you these orders himself?
Well, no. Princess Lerna has been appointed chamberlain. Until such time as the king recovers, of course.
But his illness doesn't prevent him from issuing orders.
Princess Lerna struck me as a very conscientious and dutiful daughter, Lord Velsus put in. If it is any consolation, I discerned a considerable reluctance in her bearing when she reported her father's word.
Valin found himself unable to suppress a chuckle.
Ever played Keshet, my lord? Velsus narrowed his eyes, his lips curling in anger, and he leaned across the table.
I do not understand your meaning, you ignorant savage.
Nor do I care to. Your king has given his word. Will you abide by it or not?
Altelnar cleared his throat. Princess Lerna did ask me to pass on word of your father, my lord.
He balked at the intensity of the gaze Valin turned on him, but forged ahead valiantly.
It seems he too is unwell. The various maladies of age, I'm told. Although she wished to assure you she does all she can to sustain him, and hopes to continue to do so.
Do you know why she chose you, my lord? Valin asked him.
I assume she recognized the good service I have provided. She chose you because it will be no loss to the realm if I kill you.
He turned to the Alperian.
Wait outside. I have business with Lord Velsus.
Alone with the Alperian Grand Prosecutor, he could feel the man's hatred like fire. His eyes were alive with it. Altelnar may have relished the import of the moment, but he could see Lord Velsus cared nothing for history, only justice. Or was it vengeance?
I'm told he was a good man, he said.
The hope. Velsus's eyes flashed, and his voice was a hard rasp.
You could never understand the greatness of the man you killed, the enormity of what you took from us.
He remembered the clumsy charge of the man in the white armor, the blind disregard for his own safety as he sped towards death. Had that been greatness?
Courage, certainly.
Unless the man had expected the fabled favor of the gods to protect him. In any case,
The frenzy of battle left little room for admiration or reflection. The Hope had been just another enemy in need of killing. He regretted it, but could still find no room for guilt in the memory, and the Blood Song had ever been silent on the subject. "I began this war with four brothers," he told Velsus. "Now one is dead, and the other lost to the mists of battle. The two that remain..." His voice faded. "The two that remain..." "I care nothing for your brothers," Velsus replied. "The Emperor's mercy is a great agony to me. If it were within my gift, I would see your entire army flayed and driven into the desert as a feast for the vultures." Belin met his gaze squarely. "If there is the slightest attempt to interfere with the passage of my men, the Emperor's word has been given, written and witnessed. It cannot be broken. To do so would be against the gods' will." "No, the law. We are an empire of laws, Savage. Laws that bind even the greatest of us. The Emperor's word is given." "Then it seems I have no choice but to trust it. I request it be noted that Governor Arawan gave no assistance to my forces during our tenure here. He has remained a loyal servant of the Emperor throughout. The Governor will give his own testimony, I'm sure." Belly nodded. "Very well." He rose from the table. "Tomorrow at dawn, then, a mile south of the main gate. I assume there are some Alperin forces nearby waiting your word. It would be best if you spent the night with them. If you think I will allow you out of my sight until—" "Do you want me to flog you from this city?" His tone was mild, but he knew the Alperin could hear its sincerity. Velsus's features quivered with a mixture of fury and fear. "Do you know what awaits you, Savage? When you are mine, I have to trust your Emperor's word. You'll have to trust mine." Velin turned to the door. "There is a captain of the Imperial Guard in our custody. I'll ask him to act as your escort. Please be out of the city within the hour. And feel free to take Lord Altelna with you." He had the men assembled in the main square. Renfalen knights and squires, Cambrelian archers, Nilsalins, and Realmguard, all drawn up in ranks awaiting his word. His dislike of speechmaking was still undimmed, and he saw little point in preamble. "The war is over," he told them, standing atop a cart and casting his voice towards the rear ranks so they all heard clearly. "His Highness King Janus agreed to a treaty with the Alperin Emperor 3 weeks ago. We are ordered to quit the city and return to the realm. Ships are now berthing in the harbor to take us home. You will proceed to the docks in companies, taking only your packs and weapons. No Alperin property is to be removed on pain of execution." He scanned the ranks briefly. There were no cheers, no rejoicing, just surprised relief on nearly every face. "On behalf of King Janus, I thank you for your service. Stand at ease and await orders." "Is it really over?" Barkas asked as he stepped down from the cart. "All over," he assured him. "What made the old fool give up?" "Prince Malsius lies dead in Untesh. The bulk of the army was destroyed at Marbellus, and trouble brews in the realm. I assume he wants to preserve as much of his army as he can." He noticed Canis standing nearby, possibly the only man not joining his voice to the massed babble of relief. His brother's slender face showed a mix of mystification and what could only be described as grief. "It seems there's to be no greater unified realm, brother," he said, keeping his tone gentle. Kenneth's gaze was distant, as if in deep shock. "He does not make mistakes," he said softly. "He never makes mistakes." "We're going home." Benin laid hands on his shoulders, giving him a shake. "You'll be back at the Order House in a couple of weeks." "Bugger the Order House," Barker said. "I'll be making for the nearest dockside tavern, where I intend to stay until this whole bloody farce has become a bad dream." Benin clasped hands with both of them. "Canis, your company will take the first ship, Barker's take the second. I'll keep order while the rest of the men embark." Lord Altelnar opted to take the first ship home, rather than wait for the climax of this moment in history. His face stiff with resentment, when Velin delayed him at the gangplank. Tell my brother nothing of the treaty until we reach the realm. He glanced over at where Caenus stood on the prow of the ship, his bearing still so forlorn. They had all lost more than they should in this war. Friends and brothers. But Caenus had lost his delusion. His dream of Janus's greatness. He wondered if his desolation would turn to hate when he heard the full details of the treaty.
As you wish, Altenar replied shortly. Anything further, my lord? Or may I depart?
He felt he should give him some message for Princess Lerna, but found he had nothing to say. As he could feel no guilt over killing the Hope, he was surprised to discover he also had no more anger towards her. He stood aside to let Altenar board, and waved to Caenus as the gangplank was hauled aboard, and the ship began to pull away from the quay. Caenus answered with a brief and distracted wave of his own, before turning away.
Goodbye, brother, Velin whispered.
Barkas was next to go, urging his men aboard with a hearty bluster that failed to mask the haunted look his eyes had taken on since his return from Marbellus.
Come on! Step faster, you lot! Whores and innkeepers won't wait forever!
His mask almost slipped completely when Velin approached, his face tense as he fought to suppress tears.
You're not coming, are you?
Velin smiled and shook his head.
I can't, brother.
Sister Sharon?
He nodded.
There's a ship waiting to take us to the far west.
Armlin knows of a quiet corner of the world where we can live in peace.
Peace. Wonder what that's like. Think you'll like it?
Velin laughed.
I have no idea.
He extended his hand, but Barkas ignored it to enfold him in a crushing embrace.
Any message for the Aspect?
He asked, stepping back.
Only that I've decided to leave the Order. He can keep the coins.
Barkas nodded, hefted his hateful axe, and strode up the gangplank without a backward glance. He stood unmoving on the foredeck as the ship pulled away, like one of Arm Lin's statues, a great and noble warrior, frozen in stone.
Velin would always prefer to think of him like this, in the years that followed.
He stayed on the quay to watch them all leave, Lord Altendril hounding his regiment onto the ships with a flurry of waspish insults, offering Velin the most cursory of bows before boarding. It seemed he had never quite forgiven him for taking away the chance of profiting from the war. Count Marvin's Nilsaelins scrambled aboard the ships with unabashed eagerness, a few calling jocular farewells to Velin as they sailed away. The Count himself seemed unusually cheerful. Now all chance of glory had evaporated, it seemed he had no more cause for enmity.
I lost more men to brawls than to battle, he said, offering Velin his hand.
For which I think my fief owes you its thanks, my lord. Velin shook his hand.
What will you do now?
Marvin shrugged. Go back to hunting outlaws and wait for the next war.
You'll forgive me if I hope you have a long wait.
The Count grunted a laugh and strolled onto his ship, accepting a bottle of wine from his men, who sang heartily as the ship drew away.
Desert winds blow hard at me, till we reach the shining sea, and borne away across the waves, my lover's life I'll sail to save.
Baron Banders and his knights labored onto the ships under the weight of their disassembled armor. Of all of the contingents, their mood was the most varied. A few weeping openly over the loss of the great war horses, which had had to be left behind. Others clearly drunk and laughing uproariously.
Sorry spectacle they make without armor and horses, eh?
Banders asked, his own faux-rusted plate balanced on the shoulders of an unfortunate squire, who stumbled several times before successfully heaving it onto the ship.
They're fine men, Velin told him. Without them, the city would have fallen, and there would be no homecoming for any of us.
True enough. When you return to the realm, I hope you'll visit me. Always a full table in my manor.
I shall, and gladly.
He shook the Baron's hand.
You should know Altenar brought details of the events at Marbellus.
It seems the Battle Lord and a few others managed to fight their way to the docks when the walls fell. About 50 men managed to escape in all. Fief Lord Theros was not among them. But his son was. The Baron's laugh was harsh and his face grim.
Vermin always find a way to survive, it seems.
Forgive me, Baron, but what happened at Marbellus to cause the fief lord to dismiss you? You've never told me.
When we finally fought our way in, the slaughter was terrible, and not confined to Alperian soldiery. Women and children.
He closed his eyes and sighed. I found Darnell and two of his knights raping a girl next to the bodies of her parents. She couldn't have been more than 13. I killed the two others, and was trying to geld Darnell when the fief lord's mace laid me low. He's scum, right enough, he told me the next day. But he's also the only son I have. So he sent me to you. Have a care when you return to your lands. Lord Darnell doesn't strike me as a forgiving soul.
Banders replied with a grim smile. Neither am I, brother.
Sergeants Krelnick, Gallus, and General Norrin were the last of the wolf runners to leave. He shook hands with each of them, and thanked them for their service.
It's been less than 10 years, he told Gallus, but if you wish to be released, it is within my discretion.
We'll see you in the realm, my lord, Gallus said, snapping off an impeccable salute and marching onto the ship, quickly followed by Krelnick and Norrin.
The Cumbrellian archers were the last contingent onto the ships. He had offered to place them ahead of the Renfalians, for fear they might suspect some perfidious Darkblade plot to abandon them to the Alperians, but Bren Antesh had surprised him by insisting they wait until all others had gone. He supposed there was a possibility of ambush. He was alone with 1,000 men, who saw him as an enemy of their god after all. But they all trooped onto the ships without trouble, most either ignoring him or offering nods of wary respect.
They're grateful for their lives, Antesh said, reading his expression. But they'll be damned if they'll say it.
So I will.
He bowed, Velin realizing it was the first time he had done so.
You're welcome, Captain.
Antesh straightened, glanced at the waiting ship, and then back at Velin.
This is the last ship, my lord.
I know.
Antesh raised his eyebrows as realization dawned.
You don't intend to return to the realm.
I have business elsewhere.
You shouldn't linger here. All these people have to offer you is an ugly death.
Is that what happens to the Dark Blade in the prophecy?
Hardly.
He is seduced by a sorceress, who makes herself a queen with the power to conjure fire from the air. Together they wreak terrible ruin on the world, until her fire consumes him in the throes of their sinful passion.
Well, at least I have that to look forward to.
He returned Antesh's bow.
Luck to you, Captain.
I have something to tell you, Antesh said, his normally placid features somber. I did not always carry the name Antesh. Once I had another name, one you know.
The blood song surged, not in warning, but clear and strident triumph.
Tell me, he said.
Armlin's burns had healed well, but his scars would linger for the rest of his life. A large patch of puckered, discolored tissue marred the right side of his face, from cheek to neck, and similarly ugly scars were visible on his arms and chest. Despite this, he appeared as affable as ever, although his sadness at what Valen asked of him was obvious.
She has preserved me, cared for me, he said. To do such a thing,
would you do any less for your wife? Valen asked.
I would follow my song, brother. Are you?
He recalled the pure, triumphant note of the blood song, as he had listened to what Antesh had to say.
More closely than I ever have before.
He met the mason's gaze.
Will you do this thing I ask?
It seems our songs are in agreement, so I have little choice.
Sherin knocked at the door and entered, bearing a bowl of soup.
He needs to eat, she said, placing the bowl next to the mason's bed and turning to Velin.
And you need to help me pack. Velin touched Armlin briefly on the hand, by way of thanks, and followed her from the room. She had taken over Sister Gilmer's old quarters in the basement of the guild house, and was busily sorting out which of the myriad bottles and boxes of curatives to take with her. I've managed to procure a small chest for your things, she told him, moving to a shelf where her hand traced along the line of bottles, picking out some, leaving others.
I only have these, he replied.
taking a bundle from his cloak and handing it to her. The wooden blocks Frentis had brought with him, wrapped in Sella's scarf. Not much of a dowry, I know. She gently undid the scarf, fingers pausing to play over the intricate design. Very fine. Where did you come by this?
A gift of thanks from a beautiful maiden.
Should I be jealous?
Hardly.
She's half a world away, and I suspect married to a handsome blonde fellow we used to know. Sharon pulled the blocks apart.
Winterbloom.
From my sister.
You have a sister? A blood sister?
Yes. I only met her once. We spoke of flowers. She reached to clasp his hand, summoning an overpowering need for her, so fierce and powerful as to almost make him forget what he had asked of Armlin. Forget the aspect, the war, the whole sorry blood-soaked tale. Almost.
Governor Arawan is arranging the ship, but we have hours yet, he said, moving to the table where she prepared her concoctions, sitting down to unstopper a bottle of wine.
Quite possibly the last bottle of Cumbrelian Red left in the city.
Will you drink with the former Lord Marshal of the 35th Regiment of Foot, Sword of the Realm and Brother of the 6th Order?
She arched an eyebrow.
Have I saddled myself with a drunkard, I wonder?
He reached for two cups and poured a measure of red in each.
Just have a drink, woman.
Yes, my lord, she said in mock civility, sitting opposite and reaching for a cup.
Did you tell them?
Just Barkus. The others think I'm following on the last ship.
We could still go back. With the war over.
There's no place for you there now.
You said so yourself.
But you're losing so much.
He reached across the table and grasped her hand.
I'm losing nothing. And gaining everything. She smiled and sipped her wine.
And the task the Aspect set you. Is it complete?
Not quite. By the time we leave here, it will be.
Can you tell me now?
Am I finally allowed to know?
He squeezed her hand.
I don't see why not.
It had been cold that day, colder than usual even for Wesleyan. Aspect Arlin stood at the edge of the practice field, watching Master Hornlin teach the staff to a group of novice brothers. Belin judged them as third-year survivors from their age, and the comparative smallness of the group. In the distance, Mad Master Rensil was trying to ride down another group of boys, his shrill tones carrying well in the chill air.
"Brother Valin,"
the Aspect greeted him.
"Aspect, I request lodging for the 35th Regiment of Foot during the winter months."
At the Aspect's insistence, it had become a ritual between them to formally request lodging every time the regiment returned to the order house. Recognition of the fact that, funding and equipment notwithstanding, it remained a part of the realm guard.
Granted.
How was Nilsel?
Cold, Aspect.
They had spent the better part of 3 months on the Nilselian border with Cumbril, hunting a particularly savage and fanatical band of god-worshippers, calling themselves the Sons of Trueblade. One of their less savory habits was the abduction and forcible conversion of Nilselian children, many of whom had been subjected to various forms of abuse to force their adherence. Some killed outright when they proved too intractable or troublesome. The pursuit through the hill country and valleys of southern Nilsel had been difficult, but the regiment had harried the band with such ferocity they were down to barely 30 men by the time they were cornered in a deep gully. They immediately killed their remaining captives, a brother and sister of 8 and 9 stolen from a Nilsenian farmhouse a few days before, then loosed arrows at the wolf-runners whilst singing prayers to their god. Velin left it to Dentos and his archers to wipe them out to a man, something he found troubled his conscience not at all.
"Casualties?" the Aspect inquired.
4 dead, 10 injured.
"Regrettable. And what did you learn about these, what was it, Sons of the True Blade?"
"They considered themselves followers of Henter's Muster, believed by many Cumbrellans to embody the prophesied True Blade from their 5th book."
"Ah, yes. Apparently there is an 11th book being touted around Cumbrel. The Book of the True Blade.
telling the tale of the usurper's life and martyrdom. The Cumbrellian bishops have condemned it as heretical, but many of their followers are clamoring to read it. It's always the way with such things. Burn a book, and the ashes spawn 1,000 copies. It seems by killing one lunatic, we have grown another branch to their church. Ironic, don't you think? Very, Aspect. He hesitated, gathering strength for what he had to say. But as ever, the Aspect was ahead of him. King Janus wants my support for his war. Does anything ever surprise you? Valen wondered. Yes, Aspect. Tell me, Valen, do you believe Alperian spies lurk in every alleyway and bush, preparing the way for their armies to invade our lands? No, Aspect. And do you believe Alperian deniers abduct our children to defile in unspeakable, god-worshipping rites? No, Aspect. In that case, do you think that the future wealth and prosperity of this realm is dependent on securing the three principal Alperian ports on the Irinian Sea? I do not, Aspect. And yet you come to ask for my support on behalf of the king. I come to ask for guidance. The king has placed my father and his family under threat, in order to ensure my obedience. But I find I cannot preserve them, whilst thousands die in a pointless war. There must be some way to steer the king away from this course. Some pressure that can be brought against him. If all the orders were to speak as one, the time when the orders spoke as one is long past. Aspect Tendris hungers for war against the unfaithful, like an ale-starved drunkard, whilst our brothers in the Third Order lose themselves in their books and watch the events of the world with cold detachment. The Fifth Order, by custom, takes no part in politics, and as for the First and Second, they consider communion with their souls and the souls of the departed to take precedence over all earthly concerns. Aspect, I am given to believe there is another order, with possibly more power than all the others combined. He was expecting some register of shock or alarm, but the Aspect's only expression was a slightly raised eyebrow. I see this is the day all secrets are to be revealed, brother. He clasped his long-fingered hands together and concealed them within his robe, turning and gesturing with his head. Come, walk with me. Frost crunched underfoot as they walked together in silence. From the practice field came the shouts and grunts of pain and triumph, as he remembered so well. It made him ache with unexpected nostalgia. For all the pain and the loss of his years within these walls, it had been a simpler time, before the schemes of kings and the secrets of the faith brought darkness and confusion into his life. "How did you come by this knowledge?" the Aspect asked eventually. "I met a man in the north, a brother of an order long thought to be a myth by the faithful. He told you of the Seventh Order, not without persuasion and only up to a point. He did confirm that the continued existence of the Seventh Order is a secret known to all the Aspects. Although, given the recent rift with the Fourth Order, I suspect Aspect Tendris remains in ignorance of this information. Indeed he does, and it is vital his ignorance continues. Wouldn't you agree?" "Certainly, Aspect. What do you know of the Seventh Order?" "That it is to the dark as we are to war, and the Fifth Order is to healing." "Quite so. Although our brothers and sisters in the Seventh Order do not refer to the dark, they regard themselves as guardians and practitioners of dangerous and arcane knowledge, much of which defies such mundane concepts as names or categories." "And would they use such knowledge to aid us?" "Of course. They always have and continue to do so to this day. The man I met in the north spoke of a war within the faith, of some within the Seventh Order becoming corrupted by their power." "Corrupted or deluded, who can say? There is much that remains known only to the vanished years. What is clear is that members of the Seventh Order came to possess knowledge best left hidden, that somehow they reached into the beyond and touched something. Some spirit or being of such power and malice that it came close to destroying our faith and the realm with it." "But it was defeated?" "Contained, might be a better word. But it lurks there still,
in the beyond, waiting. And there are those called to do its bidding, plotting, and killing at its instruction. The Aspect Massacre. That and more. Velin thought back to his confrontation with One Eye beneath the city, of what he had told Frentis as he carved the complex pattern of scars into his chest. The one who waits. This time the Aspect's surprise was clear. You have been busy, haven't you? Who is he? The Aspect paused, turning to regard the boys on the practice field. Perhaps he is Master Renziel, his apparent madness all these years merely a cloak for his true design. Or his Master Hounlin, who never did say how he came by those burns. Or is he you, I wonder? There was an unnerving intensity to the Aspect's gaze as he turned to Valin. What better disguise could there be, after all? Son of the Battle Lord, courageous in all things, apparently without flaw, loved by the faithful. What better disguise indeed? Valin nodded. Quite. It would only be surpassed by you, Aspect. The Aspect blinked slowly and turned away to resume his walk. My point is that he remains too well hidden, and no device or effort by the Seventh Order has yet revealed him. He could be a brother of the Order, or a soldier in your regiment, or even someone with no connection to the Order at all. The prophecies are vague on the method, but are clear that it is the purpose of the One Who Waits to destroy this Order. Valin frowned in puzzlement. The concept of prophecy was not a feature of the faith. Prophets and their visions were the province of false beliefs, of God-worshippers, and deniers who clung to superstition they mistook for wisdom. Prophecies, Aspect. The One Who Waits was foretold to us many years ago by the Seventh Order. There are some within their ranks who have the gift of scrying the future, or at least the ever-changing clouds of shadow that make up the future. So they tell me. It is rare for the visions produced by such people to concur, for the shadows to coalesce into a recognizable whole. But they all agreed on two things. We will have only one chance to discover the One Who Waits, and if we fail to do so, then this order will fall. And without this order, so falls the faith and the realm. But we have a chance to stop it. One chance, yes. The last brother to make a prophecy on the subject lived over a century ago. It said he would slip into a trance and write his visions in script more precise and artful than the most skilled scribe in the land, even though he was unable to read or write when the trance was not upon him. Shortly before he died, he reached once more for his pen and left a short passage. War will unmask the One Who Waits when a king sends his army to fight beneath a desert sun. He'll seek the death of his brother, and mayhap find his own. The death of his brother. You survived two attempts on your life while still in training, the Aspect went on. We believe both were carried out by those in service to whatever malignance lurks in the beyond. For some reason it greatly desires your death. If the One Who Waits is concealed within the Order, why not simply have him kill me? Either because no such opportunity has yet arisen, or because to do so would have risked revealing his face. And he still has much to do. But amidst the chaos of war, surrounded by so much death, he may well take his chance. Valin felt a chill that owed nothing to the icy winds sweeping across the practice field. The king's war is our chance? Our only chance. Foretold by a man scribbling in a trance more than 100 years ago. You are willing to commit the order to war on the basis of this alone? After all you have seen, all you have learned, can you really doubt it? This war will happen whether we support it or not. The king has set his course and will not be dissuaded. If it happens, the realm could fall in any case. And if it doesn't, it will certainly fall. Not to warring fiefs once more, but to utter ruin the earth scorched, the forests burned to cinder, and all the people, realm folk, Siorda, and Lonak, dead. What else would you have us do?
I couldn't think of anything to say, Velin told Sharin, his thumb tracing over the smooth skin of her hand. He was right. It was horrible. Terrible, but he was right. He told me this would be a war unlike any we have known. A great sacrifice would be made. But I must return. No matter how many of my men and my brothers fell, I must return to the realm once I had completed my task. As he walked away, he told me I reminded him of my mother. I often wondered how they came to know each other. Now I suppose I'll never find out. Her head lay on the table, eyes closed, lips parted, her hand still holding the wine cup he had given her. Two parts valerian, one part crown root, and a pinch of chamomile to mask the taste, he said, stroking her hair. Try not to hate me. He dressed her in her cloak, tucking the scarf and blocks into the folds, and carried her to the harbor. She was light in his arms, fragile. Armlin waited on the quay next to a large merchant vessel, his wife Shoala clutching his hand, her face tight with suppressed tears, as she cast a forlorn gaze at the city she would likely never see again. Governor Arawan was negotiating with the vessel's captain, a stocky man from the far west, who grew alarmed at the sight of Velin. Perhaps he had been one of the captains forced to watch the burning ships after the sailors' escape attempt. Velin couldn't remember. But he quickly concluded his haggling with the governor and stomped off up the gangplank. The price is agreed, the governor told Armlin. They sail direct for the far west, first port of call. It's better if I don't know, Velin cut in. Armlin came forward to take Sharin from him, lifting her easily in his muscular mason's arms. Tell her they killed me, Velin said. As the ship pulled away from the dock, the Emperor's guard arrived and killed me. The mason gave a reluctant nod. As the song wills it, brother. She could stay here, Governor Arawan offered. The city owes her a great debt, after all. She would be in no danger. Do you really think Lord Velsus will share your gratitude, Governor? Velin asked him. The governor sighed. Perhaps not. He took a leather purse from his belt and handed it to Shoala. For her, when she wakes. With my thanks. The woman nodded, cast a final hateful glare at Velin, then a tearful glance at the city, before turning and striding up the gangplank. Velin reached out to trace his fingers through Sharon's hair, trying to burn the image of her sleeping face into his memory. Take care of her, he told Armlin. Armlin smiled. My song would have it no other way. He turned to go, then hesitated. My song holds no note of farewell, brother. I can't help but think that one day we'll sing together again. Velin nodded, stepping back as Armlin carried Sharin onto the ship. He stood with the governor as the ship pulled away from the dock, riding the tide to the harbor mouth, sails unfurling to catch the northerly winds, taking her away. He waited and watched until the sail was a faint smudge on the horizon, until it had vanished completely, and there was only the sea and the wind. He unbuckled his sword and held it out to Arawan. Governor, the city is yours. I am commanded to wait for Lord Velsus beyond the walls. Arawan looked at the sword but made no move to take it. I will speak for you. I have some influence at the Emperor's court. He is famed for his mercy. He faltered and stopped, perhaps hearing the emptiness of his words. After a moment he spoke again. Thank you for my daughter's life, my lord. Take it, Velin insisted, again holding out the sword. I'd rather you than Lord Velsus. As you wish. The governor took the sword in his plump hands. Is there nothing I can do for you? Actually, about my dog. Part 5. In longer games, where the liars attack
or one of the other openings outlined above has failed, the complexity of Keshet is fully revealed. The following chapters will examine the most effective stratagems to be employed in the long game, beginning with the Bowman's Switch, taking its name from a maneuver employed by Alperin horse archers. Like the Liar's Attack, the Bowman's Switch employs misdirection, but also retains the potential for exploiting unforeseen opportunity. A skilled player can move offensively against two objectives, leaving the opponent ignorant of the ultimate target until the most fruitful opportunity presents itself. Author unknown. Keshet. Rules and Strategies. Great Library of the Unified Realm. Vernier's Account. And? Alsorna had fallen into silence after relating his final words to the governor.
And what?
He inquired. I bit down my exasperation. It was becoming increasingly apparent that the Northman took no small pleasure from vexing me. And what followed? You know what followed. I waited outside the walls. In the morning Lord Velsus came with a troop of Imperial Guards to take me into custody. Prince Malsius was duly delivered to the realm unharmed. Janus died shortly after. Your history was fulsome in its description of my trial. What else can I tell you? I realized he was right, insofar as recorded history could relate. He had told me the entirety of his tale, providing a great deal of previously unknown information and clarification on the origins of the war and the nature of the realm that had spawned it. But I found myself possessed of a conviction that there was more, an unshakable sense that his tale was incomplete. I recalled moments when his voice had faltered, only slightly, but enough to assure me he had been holding back, perhaps concealing truths he had no desire to reveal. As I looked at the wealth of words adorning the sheets that now covered the deck around my bedroll, my mood darkened as I considered the work involved in verifying this narrative, the extensive research that would be needed to corroborate such a story. Where is the truth amongst all this? I wondered. So, I said, gathering my papers, taking care to keep them in order. This is the answer to the war? Simply the folly of a desperate old man? Alsorna had settled onto his bedroll, hands clasped behind his head, eyes cast to the ceiling, his expression somber and distant. He yawned. That's all I can tell you, my lord. Now, if you'll allow me some rest, I have to face certain death tomorrow and would prefer to meet it fully refreshed. I sifted through the pages, my quill picking out those passages where I suspected he'd been less than forthcoming. To my dismay, I found there were more than I would have liked, even a few contradictions. "You said you never met her again," I said. "Yet you say Princess Lerna was present at the Summertide Fair where Janus embroiled you in his warmongering scheme." He sighed, not turning. "We exchanged a cursory greeting only. I didn't think it worth mentioning." A dim memory came to me, a fragment from my own researches undertaken whilst preparing my history of the war. "What about the Mason?" It was only the briefest hesitation, but it told me a great deal. "Mason?" "The Mason at Linesh you befriended. His house was set alight because of it. It was a well-known story when I researched your occupation of the city. Yet you make no mention of him." He rolled onto his back and shrugged. "Hardly a friendship. I wanted him to carve a statue of Janus for the town square, something to confirm his ownership of the city. Needless to say, the Mason refused. Didn't stop someone burning his house down, though. I believe he and his wife left the city when the war ended. With good reason, it seems. And the city..."